So I'm going to go ahead and call the True Commission meeting to order. First thing we need to do is establish a quorum. So if everyone to my left can introduce themselves, we'll go that way.
Tommy Carter, Council Auditor's Office.
Bruce Tyson, CPAC 4.
Daniel Henry, True Commission.
Raymond Day, CPAC District 3.
Robert, CPAC 2.
All right. Thank you, everyone. So we clearly have a quorum. Do we have any excused absences that we need to recognize?
No, sir.
Okay. All right. I'd entertain a motion to approve the minutes from the November meeting. Thank you, Commissioner Day and Commissioner Roundsville. I'll give a second for everyone to be able to review it and let us know if there's anything that needs to be changed or edited. All right, hearing no edits, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Be opposed? Show the motion approved. So today we have the pleasure of having Kenneth, is it Darity? Mr. Darity, he is the KHA Chief Programs Officer, and he is going to give us a presentation on the Kids Help Alliance. So, Mr. Darity, the floor is yours.
And while he's passing those out, I guess a little bit about myself. I am Kenneth Darity. I'm the Chief Programs Officer with the Kids Hope Alliance. Been with the agency since 2008. Jacksonville native, bounced around from north side, east side parts of town. And so it's an honor to be working in these types of services and programs, giving back to the communities that made me the man who I am today. So. With that being said, my understanding is that you guys wanted to hear basically an overview of the services that we offer through our funding, as well as a little bit on the intervention and prevention type programs that we fund, as well as maybe some information on return on investment. So hopefully this one pager gives you a lot of that information. I'm really going to kind of talk through that with you. I'm going to read it to you. I'm just going to give you some highlights. It's yours to keep. And then a little bit more information. And then when we're done, obviously, I'll take any questions that you may have. All right. So if you flip to the back page, which would be this page, that shows our essential services, our ordinance established that we will fund programs in these essential service categories. And so you'll see early learning, juvenile justice, out of school time, preteen teen, and special needs. To back up a little bit, when I got to the agency, we were called the Jacksonville Children's Commission. And since then, the Kids Hope Alliance really is a merger of the old Jack's Journey programs and services, and that was brought up under our umbrella into our portfolio. And our new entity is Kids Hope Alliance. So just for clarification. So a lot of those programs are still with us, and still the emphasis is still on juvenile justice and all of those, the mission that agency had. So if we look at an overall snapshot of our portfolio, currently we fund about 90 providers across all of these essential service categories. We have about 200-plus contracts and about 200-plus physical locations of programs. And so those are our programs where they're more traditional face-to-face, like out-of-school time, some programs in our preteen teen, any program you would think you can physically go to and view the services taking place. Now, I want to highlight in each category, really kind of give you an idea of the return on investment and then an idea of some of the services that are funded in that area. So with early learning, you can see we have a really big partnership with the Early Learning Coalition of Jacksonville. And you can see we're funding primarily coaching. And so there's coaches that go into the daycare centers and help provide quality coaching for the staff there. They use primarily the CLASS tool, which is their quality assessment tool, and they coach up the daycare providers to provide a quality experience for the children and families there. And if you look in the box, you can see to the bottom of that, it says the highest rate of return is 13% in early childhood development. And so when we look at why we're putting funding in the early learning space, we can see there's a high rate of return when we focus on children at their early stage, right? When you catch a child at their earlier stages and you give them that head start, that's setting them up for success, especially as we talk about literacy. Next, juvenile justice. You can see the focus there, how many students were served. And again, this is a report from 2019. This is pulled right from literature that we put out in our annual reports and things of that nature. So I will say these numbers haven't changed much, and that's why I brought this report, because the numbers are pretty consistent. But I wanted to highlight, again, you can read this section where it talks about the research and the studies, but I want to talk about a couple programs that we fund in that space and how impactful it is. One program in particular is the Teen Court and Neighborhood Advisory Board. And those programs, if you're not familiar with them, they're really the same program, but one is where the teens and the juvenile justice systems themselves are actually helping to give a verdict on students, as well as the Neighborhood Advisory Board is just the adults doing the same thing. But what's great about those programs is this is an opportunity for children who would have gone into the juvenile system to get an opportunity. It really is life-changing. I had the opportunity to sit in on one in the Arlington neighborhood the other day for the first time, and I was blown away because there were a couple students. The first young man was involved in an incident where he didn't have a gun, but this was on film. A young man had a gun, basically pistol-whooped another young man on campus. And then he comes along later. It looks like a totally separate situation, but he gets in a fight with the same young man. It's all on camera. The police officer intervenes. And what's great about this is the police officer gets to make the call. And so it shows a connection and shows here locally the partnership of how the services is working here locally. So this police officer could have made a judgment call, could have went in one direction, but said, okay, he looked at the history of this young man. AB, honor roll student, quiet, keeps to himself, never had any issues with the school or law before, and made a decision to put him in the neighborhood advisory board process. And so, and what I liked about what that board did, everything they did was about helping that young man first recognize the path that he could have been on and the bad choice that he made. But also the consequences were all surrounding trying to help him get to his goals in life. So they asked him, okay, what do you want to be when you grow up? This young man said, I like working with kids. I want to do something with my hands. And they connected him to our full-service schools programs that we also fund used through taxpayer dollars, and our after-school program in the neighborhood, the carpenter shop. So now part of his consequence, he's going to volunteer so many hours a week at an after-school program, and he's going to get mental health counseling, because the backstory to that is part of his anger was coming from a traumatic experience that he had witnessing a friend of his die. And this young man had tried to pull the chain off his neck that had his friend's name on it. And that's what prompted him to punch him and get in the altercation, totally separate from these other young men and what they were trying to do. But and there was another situation that I won't go into for sake of time, but just want to give an example of the impact that these programs are making, because I know it as a young man, I made some bad choices, and by the grace of God and really some luck, I didn't get into trouble, and I'm able to be here today under different circumstances. So moving along, out of school time, our biggest funded portfolio, currently about $18 million is going into our after-school portfolio, out of probably about the $35 million or so in our total budget that goes directly to programs. And the reason being for that is out-of-school time covers the entire gamut, right? It goes from kindergarten all the way up through high school. And so we really get a big bang for our buck with out-of-school time. And a lot of our other supplemental services feed right into that, our nutrition program, full-service schools, summer camp. And so over the years, we found a really we were able to also leverage state funding. We applied for a lot of 21st century grants early on. I don't know if you remember a young lady by the name of Dolly Dillon. When I first got to the agency, she was very instrumental in applying for a lot of those 21st century funding that lasted for about 5 years, and we were able to build a base. And then afterwards, the city decided to sustain those programs. But I wanted to highlight in the out-of-school time space, you see that research shows that for every $1 invested in after-school, there's a $3 return on that. And that's primarily because of the efforts in reducing crime and juvenile delinquency. Because of the experiences, the exposure, a lot of these students are going on into careers, they're going into college, and now they're putting their taxpayer dollars right back into the community versus us spending that into the jail system. So, and I'm very proud to say that's why I started my career as an out-of-school time space. And I do think that's something I know as an agency we'll always continue to fund. Then, if we go down to the preteen teen space, there's a couple programs that you're probably very familiar with. The Mayor's Youth at Work Partnership, which offers internships, and that's a year-round program. As long as there's availability, we continue to enroll students in that. And those students are paired specifically with businesses in their areas of interest. Additionally, they receive soft skill coaching, job skill training. They even receive a bank account through ViStar. It's a really good program. In addition to that, the Mayor's Youth Advisory Council that works with young leaders in the city, helping them to really encourage leadership, advocacy. They have their meetings over here at City Council sometimes and really get to learn about making an impact. So both really good programs. In addition to that, there's preteen teen programs that are similar to the out-of-school time programs that are in high schools. For example, we have one at Andrew Jackson High School, which is my high school I graduated from. And in that program, students, a good example of that program, the effectiveness is the other day I had a chance to sit down with 25 seniors and juniors. It was a good mixture. And they had a visit from the chief of staff from Boeing. And an opportunity presented itself to those students for internships. They told them about job opportunities for minorities. They're trying to recruit. They told them and opened up opportunities for those young men and women. And so heavy focus on career and college readiness in our preteen teen space. Which is awesome, because I tell you, as I'm talking to high schoolers, again, these were ABA honor roll students in that room. And when I tell you, probably a little bit over half didn't want to have anything to do with college. Bright kids. They want to make money, and they want to make it now. One young man said, I'm going right into the merchant seaman program. A couple young men, they were very good with creating apps and drawing, and they're already going to start their business and partner. And so to capture these young people with programs such as this, get them right into the workforce, teach them skills on entrepreneurship is an area that we're trying to focus on for future funding as well. And then lastly, our special needs programs. And our special needs programs, the title can be a little confusing at first glance, but that really covers supporting children with disabilities, mental health issues, and what we would call maybe traditional special needs. And one of our biggest programs in that space, again, in the mental health realm, is full-service schools. And so and that's through our partnership with United Way and Duval County Public Schools. And I'm sorry I wasn't being really mindful of time. I wasn't sure how much I had, but I think that's a really good overview of kind of some of the services and what we do. And at this time, I'll take any questions.
Let's try to go around the dais so everyone gets an opportunity to ask their questions. So, Mr. Tyson, do you have any questions? Okay. Commissioner Chambliss?
Okay. Yeah, you guys have a lot of stuff that I'm very impressed with. So your full service schools, so basically certain schools have that or all the schools are having their full service?
Well, how it works is they're like full service school hubs. And their feeder schools go into those hubs. And so, for example, we'll have like the Rains or Rebalt Full Service Center School, and then those feed into the surrounding elementary schools. And so they're sort of strategic to try to cover the entire school system.
Okay. I've seen one at Rebalt. But this is good. I didn't know that you guys have information support services for people born with disabilities because that's my clientele.
Oh.
So I didn't know that you guys are available because, you know, a lot of time we have them with behavior issues.
Absolutely, yep. DLC Nurse and Learn is one of our providers, and they deal with really severe physical disabilities, and we've been funding them prior to me coming to the agency in 2008. We also fund Duval County Public Schools programs like Palm Avenue, if you're familiar with that school. We have the after-school program there.
Okay, I definitely didn't know that. So, with those services, do they have to have Medicaid to make sure to, you know, in reference to the therapists come and provide a service? You know, like, you know, someone has to get paid somehow. So, this is paid through a grant or Medicaid or.
So, and forgive me, this isn't my full expertise in this area. I'm going to do the best from what I understand. And so, I think it's a combination.
Okay.
And so, the provider can bill a little bit with Medicare, Medicaid, and that type of stuff. But then we also give them funding that's totally separate that they can use to continue to hire other staff who are like specialists in therapy or to provide like the equipment they need for therapy and after-school programming. And so for DLC Nursing Learn, they actually have two parts. They focus with the younger babies with disability, and they have an older population that they work with, and it's really an actual after-school program, but instead these kids are in wheelchairs, feeding tubes, or some real, you know, severe disabilities.
So to locate this, is it only at certain schools that has this?
Say that again?
The location, I mean, if I wanted to refer someone to, is it certain schools?
For our special needs schools, yes. Unfortunately, because of the specialized skill set, we currently have only focused on two schools in Duval County. And formerly it was, Palm Avenue is one.
Right.
And the other was, it was with Hope Haven. They're off of, out in the south side. I always forget.
Alden Road?
Alden Road.
Okay, that one as well. Okay.
Alden Road was the other location. Yep.
I just needed to know because I didn't often need that, so I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Sir.
Yes, I wonder if you could tell me something about the job training and career training that you give.
Absolutely. So with the Mayor's Youth at Work partnership, that contract is with Goodwill Industries, and so that's the provider that oversees that contract. And so let me back up a little bit even more. So if you weren't aware, we don't provide any direct service. all of our services go through nonprofits, and so they apply for the dollars through a competitive RFP process. We award them according to the highest score. But Goodwill Industries is the provider that oversees that program, and what they do is they provide traditional soft skill training, interviewing skills. They have a job coach that works directly that's assigned to each student in the program. And again, as I said earlier, up on the upfront part, on the application, they're asking the students what are their interests. And so then they try to pair them with an agency that is in that line. For example, I've actually had a couple of interns myself. And these students were interested in after school, being a teacher. And so I was able to take them out to some of our after school programs and surveys and sit in on meetings with providers and for them to be able to see sort of the inner workings of the programs.
You know, something you said kind of intrigued me. You indicated you provided no services. Can you describe a bit just what your organization does?
Absolutely. So I will say in the past, we did dabble a little bit in direct services. And I think part of us becoming KHA, some of that was kind of hashed out that there was a philosophy, whatever you want to call it, that we shouldn't be involved in direct services. And so some of the direct services we were doing in the past, we gave some of that to the Early Learning Coalition because we had job coaches who were from Children's Commission at that point. We had, there were grants that we managed that we provided direct services. We ran a 21st century after school program. But to answer your question, what we actually do now is the management of all of those contracts and grants through our current CEO, Mr. Weinstein, Michael Weinstein. He's reshaped the organization to where we can be more efficient on the management of those contracts. And so we're really divided up into two parts, an admin team, which is our finance department, our communications department, focusing on sort of getting the good news out to the community. Unfortunately, over the years, we've had some negative publicity that's taken away from the good work that we're funding. And so we've really tried to ramp up our social media presence, our website, make that new and modern. And as you go downstairs to sort of my shop, the program shop, we focus primarily on being the eyes and ears out into the community as far as what's taking place. We assess the programs with formalized assessment tools, work with them for continuous improvement. And then I have a contract management team who's responsible for ensuring they get the contract in a timely manner, that they're processing payment. And also we're holding providers accountable and that we have something to report out on the effectiveness of the funding. And so that's where our priorities sort of have shifted. We've had some audits over the years, and we've had some findings on that just, you know, weren't doing as good of a job as we could on documenting and capturing what we were doing. And so this is a way to, we've sort of shifted to kind of fill in those gaps.
Mr. Darity, so that you mentioned about a direct program budget of around $35 million. Mm-hmm. What is the total budget of Kids Hope Alliance?
Well, I don't know the total budget, to be honest. That's my counterpart's shop, Dr. Sarah Lynn Grass. I would say right about now it's about $42 to $45 million total.
So roughly $7 million administrative costs, yep, for your staff, the organization, et cetera.
Yep, benefits
and direct
and
program about $35 million.
Absolutely.
Okay, great.
So
thank you.
Roundabout, and that's without knowing specific COVID dollars that we've received and things of that nature.
Maybe about a 15% administrative factor in the total budget.
I'd probably say we're closer to 10%. My finance director probably would hit me across the head for throwing figures out there, but I would say it's probably closer to 10%. We've never, since I've been with the agency, been high on staff salaries. The bulk of our budget has always been about going to the community and funding them. And I'll tell you, we have our staff are loaded up as far as cases. As I said earlier, they're averaging probably closer to 30 per person. We definitely could use more staff, but I think we're doing a good job with who we have and how we're managing the contracts.
Thank you.
Supervisor manage all contracts involving children? Or is there some sort of dividing line that determines whether you manage a contract or someone else manages it?
Well, in theory, any city, anything that's revolving children typically comes through Kids Hope Alliance, and we manage. There are probably some contracts out there across the city. Maybe if you look at Parks and Rec, there may be a little bit of overlap. But even in those special circumstances, we partner a lot, especially with summer camp. A lot of partnership on that to make sure that the parents who are receiving their vouchers, we've come alongside in times and make sure that they didn't have to pay anything. So it's a really good partnership. But for the most part, yep, if it's a children's service, it comes through the Kids Hope Alliance. It's another agency, and forgive me, the juvenile justice space is the one I'm learning. I have the most learning to do, but it's through like the fourth. I'm not even going to try to answer that, but it's not a direct service. Yeah, I was going to say like the fourth judicial service, something to that. It's not us. It's not us. And yeah, no direct services for us. We for that contract, we're paying the primarily for like their case managers.
Question.
Yes, ma'am.
So I'm not sure if you mentioned it or not. So the age group is, I guess, from 17 and below, as far as what she was talking about the program, the juvenile justice program, mm-hmm. like the court, you know, the ones that get in trouble and you know, and the officer decided, you know, not to do something differently than what
right.
could have been done, something preventive. Mm-hmm. So I'm saying that I'm assuming 17 and below.
I don't know off the top of my hand what the age range is, but from what I've seen, that is pretty much the 17 and below. I know per our ordinance, 18 is pretty much what we're focused on. We are looking into trying to increase that for specific areas, with the exception of special needs. Obviously, when you're looking at sites like Alden Road, Palm Avenue, some of those students are 22, 23.
Right.
As long as they're in the Duval County Public School, that's sort of the difference when we get to age range. But, yes, 18 and under.
Okay, 18 and
yep.
under. Okay, that's good.
I had a couple questions, but I wanted to wait till the end to everyone get a chance to ask theirs. I'm the long-winded one.
Yes. Yes.
Did everyone get a chance to ask their questions?
I think we did it.
Okay. So I was taking notes along the way. I get excited for this kind of stuff. One area that I was really interested in, not because I personally went through it, but I went through something similar through it, was the internship program. Particularly when it came to like the youth council and how that works with kids going to getting certain job opportunities. I know you kind of briefly went through it. Can you mm-hmm. explain that in more detail as to how that kind of works, like who's eligible, what employers mm-hmm. are in the program, and then how it's kind of funded?
We'll do. So the funding for that program, again, comes directly from us to Goodwill Industries. And so we give the funding to Goodwill, and they manage the entire program and process. They are responsible for taking the applications. Eligible students can go to the Goodwill Industries website, and there's a tab on there to apply for the internship program. They do all the onboarding. They do the soft skills training. They provide the job coaches, and they place the students with and they recruit the businesses in other industries to pair the students as well. I will say over the years, though, the city itself has been willing to pair students throughout the city in different departments to utilize our network and opportunities. And so the city is a key partner in that process as well.
So do you know how much that line of funding gets?
I don't know that total budget off the top of my head. I do know we recently just are going to be voting to increase that budget, $225,000. And we're looking to serve between 300 and 400 students each year right now. And so we're trying to get to a place where we can continue to increase that amount, because we're hearing a lot from the community about a need for that. But as a side note, that additional funding actually is in partnership with another program that we just funded. They're going to work with that agency to help pair those students with jobs in the STEM field. STEM focus.
Do you know how many kids are eligible? Like, is there a headcount cap?
Right now, we're looking at about 400 per year. And we really have a rolling application process. And so as long as there's seats available, they continue to hire students throughout the year. There's a summer component that ended. We're currently in the fall, and there's going to continue to leave it open in the spring as well. The challenge we've been facing, we found out transportation is becoming a major issue. Even during the summer, a lot of students didn't have transportation, and so even though we had all these openings and positions, the kids couldn't get to the jobs. Part of that funding went towards trying to be innovative and give out bus passes to the students, and we asked Goodwill about that. They said even that was a challenge because of the bus route, getting to the bus route. Some of the students were located so far from the bus route, that was a challenge to walk, and then timing and catching the bus. But we're still looking at that. We're going to continue to try to be innovative, but we do know transportation right now is a major challenge.
Are there any other alternatives that you guys are looking at in terms of what JTA could provide outside of just providing bus passes, like direct routes or them having a specialized line for that kind of thing, with like different vehicles that they may have available to them?
I think that's a really good idea. And I say I would be open to any suggestions that this commission has to offer. And I'll definitely leave my card. And if you have any innovative ideas that we can look into, I'll definitely pass that on to Goodwill or any other area in our portfolio. But no, I didn't think about that.
I think someone's...
Senior Services has a lot of transportation.
I can't speak for Goodwill. I don't know what all they've done. I do know the only thing they offer, they stated was bus passes, was they looked into that. And this is their first full year. This will be the first full year of the contract. And so they're also learning about some challenges, because previously actually was a direct service up under the city. And so as they learn more about the population, I think they'll be positioned to better serve them and get more students in. But again, any ideas such as that, please send that to me. And I'm mentally taking notes, but if you wouldn't mind formally sending me something, I'd love to have that in writing to be able to pass that on to Goodwill.
Happy to.
Thank you.
Is there a certain how do you kind of recruit these kids? Like, how do they know about this program and the availability? Is it something that you work with DCPS to advertise? Is it something that you do directly to certain schools or age frames? I'm just curious to see how people find out about it.
So another opportunity for improvement, to be honest. What I've heard in that area, well, let me first tell you what we are doing. We blasted on all our social media platforms. For one, we know that's where the quickest way to reach our younger population. So we blasted on our website, our Twitter, our Facebook. We tagged our providers on it. And Goodwill does their own outreach efforts. And then besides that, that's sort of the extent of what Kids Hope Alliance has done as far as our social media presence. We used to have a lot of walk-up traffic to the building. Obviously, last 2 years with COVID, that we don't have that anymore. Back then, we would also have flyers and things we would hand out, and the front desk would be prepared to share that information. The reason I say it's still opportunity, because I do personally get calls from time to time for parents asking me, how do I get an application? I've heard about the program. Are there still openings, things of that nature? So we know it's not getting out to the entire community. And probably if it did, a lot of people would be upset even more because of there's not a lot of openings. And so we're, like I said earlier, we're looking at about 300 to 400 youth right now. And so, but we are and will be working on better ways to communicate that and get that out.
So I'll disclose this. One of the main reasons why I'm really interested in that particular piece is I went to school at A. Philip Randolph, and they had a partnership my senior year with CSX with graduating seniors. So they took a class of about 10 individuals after we graduated high school, and we had a summer internship. And if the department we were in still needed us, we could still work there during the summer or during our fall or spring semester if we were still going to school locally. So I ended up staying there for almost 3 years as an intern, became an employee, and then I was there for almost 8 years. And that only happened because of that partnership that they had. So sometimes giving people that opportunity when you would otherwise never have it can really change someone's trajectory as to what their life is going to be.
Yeah.
So I just wish, but that's something that my school specifically had with that company. It wasn't something that was either organized by the district or by the city at all. It was just kind of something that was very fairly unique. So when you were talking about this, it seemed really similar, but I was just curious to see how widespread it was. Sorry, I see your hand.
Is that this program? The city has people every summer. Humans come and work in the city in different departments. He had one in this management, and she's got full time employees.
Oh, wow. That's a success story.
I was wondering, is that part of the same, or did it become this other program, or is that a separate program?
No, that sounds like the Mayor's Youth at Work Partnership Program. And so I'm assuming that
it was run by the city before.
Yeah.
So I'm just wondering if that's part of this.
Yeah, that's the same program, Mayor's Youth at Work Partnership. The only difference is back then probably we were actually managing it as a direct service. We had a staff member at the agency who went out, did recruitment, worked with convening providers, managed the soft skill training, was over the job coaches and finding them. But now we've contracted that out to Goodwill. So same program. It's just one of the services that we took from in-house and contracted it out.
I guess my last kind of question, it's more of a policy question, so I don't know whether or not you can or you can't answer it. The model that you kind of describe for KHA seems, if I'm as a layman describing it, it's almost like the agency has a bucket of money. It has priorities as to what it wants those dollars to be spent on, and then it partners with not-for-profits in Jacksonville to provide those type of services based on that funding. Is that
That's pretty spot on.
So do you look at other like agencies across the state or across the country to see how that model works in comparison to direct services? I'm just curious to see how, compared to what the city used to do,
mm-hmm.
to now, in terms of the data, how it's showing to work or not working in areas where you kind of may have to create hybrid models or...
What I'll say to that is our ordinance does give us the flexibility to still provide direct services in the event there's no one else doing it locally. And so that was left in there for the sake of if we come across a need, right, in one of those areas, we can still provide that service and that need. But what we would like to do is we know there's providers who are out there, that's their mission, that's expertise. We simply put that out and have them compete for the funding and let the top providers provide those services. And so, but there is still opportunity if we see that there's a need and there's no one else out there doing it, we can, as an agency, still provide direct services.
Okay. And then, sorry, there is one more last question. How does this dynamic work with the school board? Because I'm assuming they have a similar like mission. So I'm just curious to see how that works with similar programs that they may be doing that in some ways I'm assuming competes or kind of works in the same kind of pathway.
Mm-hmm. Well, I wouldn't look at it as competition at all. We see Duval County Public Schools as a strategic partner, especially in the out-of-school time space. A lot of our essential service categories, as I was mentioning, we have them strategically in schools. We have been a part of the school's school improvement plan for the longest, and so we really look at ourselves as strategic partners. What we try to do, though, is before we place a program in a school, I'm in contact with my counterpart over at Duval County Public Schools, and we talk about locations prior to putting an RFP out. And so we get a lot of direction from Duval County Public Schools where the need is. And then we also try not to saturate a school that has tons of services already.
Makes sense.
Does anyone else have any other follow-up questions?
Thank you.
Thank you so much. We really appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you.
It was
my pleasure. And I'm going to leave my business card if you guys only have one. I'm sorry. I should have done a better job.
Jeff will send it to all of us.
Yep. Thank you very much. You have a good rest of your day.
All right, thank you. You too. Thank you. All right. Do we have any public comment? Empty gallery. No public comment. All right, so we'll go right into the auditor's report.
Sir, thank you through the chair to the commission. The council auditor's office has released three reports since the last Drew Commission meeting. Special report number 852, budget summary for fiscal year 21-22, was released on November 30th of 2021. This report basically summarizes the review and the changes made by the Finance Committee and City Council to the proposed fiscal year 2021 budget. This report is a good overview of the budget that was passed back in September. Has different schedules in it and for the entire city. Special report number 853 is the Council Auditor's Office annual report for fiscal year 2021. It was also released on November 30th of 2021. This report gives an overview of all the council auditors, what they worked on throughout fiscal year 2021. The auditor's office released 31 reports in total, five performance audit reports, three attestations, 16 follow-ups, and then seven special reports. The report also gives a structure of our office, the audit section, the legislative section, and the special report section. The legislation section reviewed 533 bills. Identified savings and avoided appropriating funds that were not necessary of over $700,000. A lot of time was devoted to the proposed Lot J development for review of that. And then the report goes into a little more in depth of the reports that we had issued. And third report was report number 751B. The follow-up on fire and rescue department, ambulance billing, and inventory audit was released today, December 2nd, 2021. And this is the second follow-up on report 751. From this report, like I said before, this was the second follow-up. The original audit had 16 issues. This one had three to follow up on, and then there was one that was cleared. There are two remaining issues. That kind of counts as one finding, but they're together. And basically, during our original audit, we found discrepancies between a sample of items listed on hand and the logistical support facility system and the tactical support facility database, and the quantity of items on the shelves. And at the time, we recommended that JFRD conduct routine and surprise inventory counts. As part of our first follow-up, we discovered the managers of the tactical support facility and logistical support facility had only been in those positions for a short time, and both stated they had never been a surprise count since they had been in their positions. So during this follow-up testing, we were informed that JFRD could not confirm that the inventory counts were being performed. Once we inquired, inventory counts were performed for both the logistical support facility and tactical support facility inventory. However, these inventory counts were not occurring in a manner consistent with the office's policy. So we continued to recommend we'll follow up again on this finding. JFRD responded; they agreed with our finding. They said they've implemented a procedure to ensure that surprise inventory accounts occur on a schedule. And that they said the surprise inventory accounts using the above list of procedures occurred already on April 1, 2021 and October 25, 2021. Anybody have any questions on those reports?
I have a question about external. Oh, go ahead.
Well, the manager, well.
Somebody scheduled it, then it could, yes.
I guess if the people in the facilities don't know the schedule, mm-hmm. and the managers have set schedule, picking days, but that would be,
better wording would have been on a regular basis instead of on a schedule, because schedule kind of indicates you gotta,
it's a regular thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. I understand.
Sorry. No, it's okay.
I looked at this surprise schedule.
It's gonna fall out of the sky. Someone's gonna fax it over. On the external auditors portion in the council auditors report, so what do the external auditors actually review? Is it the entire government or certain pieces? Or
that is for the annual comprehensive financial
report. So it's for the entire city government.
Also, JEA
performs annual financial report.
All the independent agencies do.
But
we assist the external auditors for JEA. Because the council auditor's office employees work at a cheaper hourly rate than the external auditors.
Oh, I can guarantee that. Thank you for your service. Yes, sir.
I don't know if this is relevant to your question or not, but in the finance committee meeting is where the committee has been talking to the independent auditor. Council members have asked in the past, what's the scope of what they do? And they basically, they review the finances of the city. They review the financial reports. They don't delve into inventorying. I forget what issue it was that was in the paper not long before the auditors came in one time. Well, why didn't you guys find that? Well, we're not, that's not what independent auditors do. We can do that if you want to hire us to go investigate some department where you think something might be going on.
Mm-hmm.
But we review financial reports. We're not going into the nuts and bolts of how every department does its business. Mm-hmm. So we would never find stuff like that.
Mm. No, I get that. So
financial audit, not an operational audit.
Exactly. Performance, right, correct.
I was just curious to see if it included all the independent agencies as well, or if it just was the city.
When the for the city's comprehensive annual report, that is just for the cities. The part brought in as a part of the component. They all have their own independent audits that are done.
Okay.
And any more questions on the follow-ups? Okay. Last meeting, we had talked about, and I was just finally able to get the information, so I apologize for not sending out an email, regarding the organizations that received the COVID. And the question was brought up regarding was there any vetting? Who would do the vetting? From my understanding, the vetting was done by each council member on the organizations. And then regarding any reporting requirements, the recipients have to comply with the American Rescue Plan Act grant requirements. And each recipient had to sign this as a standard ARP Act sub-recipient grant. There's a grant agreement which they agreed to keep certain records available. And as part of the legislation that went through, the city, the finance department, the council auditor's office, and the office of inspector general all have audit rights to request books and records. So that's what they have as far as, you know, keeping records. And as far as, you know, do they have to report anything? I wasn't able to find that they have to. There's not a reporting requirement of how they spent the money. They have to keep the records of showing what they spent. And then if someone comes back and says, okay, show me what it was, if it was not in compliance, then they would be addressed at that point.
Does the council auditor's office plan on doing any random reviews of any? Not necessarily. I'm not going to single out them. I'll say overall, where you have the rights to do so for entities that received CARES Act funding.
No, I'm not involved with the risk assessment, so I don't know.
Okay.
Further questions? That concludes my report.
Thank you.
Any questions? All right, committee reports. I know the audit committee hasn't met in a while, so Commissioner Roberts, do you have anything from legislative tracking, from bills that you find interesting?
Well, the bills have been more or less mediocre. You have a list here of by type, but there are bills that interest me. Oh, it had been authorized to build some storage facilities in areas that were food deserts. And there have been two postponements of the date. The original completion date should have been this year. It's off another year. And that's an organization, you know, that from the board has resigned, accusing the president of competency, etc. Well, the second one really turned out to be bizarre in certain ways. It's a contract that the Office of Economic Development is making with the Central Automobile Company to build electric trucks. I was fascinated by the name and the company. And so I did some research. And I found, for example, that it had previously been found further that it through a holding company.
And the holding company is called Greenland Technologies Holding Corporation. And it has jumped around over the place. It's been the British Virgin Islands, organized in there. It's organized in Beijing. It's organized in the United States. And there it operates to simply to acquire technology company. One man seems to be central to it, Peter Wang, who has both been in Greenland industry technology and in Central Automobile. Central Automobile did have some activities in Bulgaria. Product was bikinis and exotic underwear, and the primary company was Fredericks of Hollywood. This company is merging with Central Corporation.
Can't look at you when you're saying it.
Well, they're merging with them, and trying to figure out a motive for the merger, but somehow $282 million is supposed to come out of clear air. Mm-hmm. And this may be a transfer through the Chinese connection.
Mm-hmm. Maybe.
That's one thing.
The second thing is that
the Naked Brands Incorporated was about to be delisted by NASQUAD because its stock had fallen below a dollar.
Mm.
What service are they particularly providing?
To the.
Well, they're supposed to be setting up a manufacturing plant here of some sort to make electric trucks. But they're going
talking about 34 people.
And I don't think you could organize much of a factory with 34 jobs. Mm. So I'm not sure.
Is it just a city grant or is it a state city company?
Like to be was just the description of the.
I haven't been able to get a hold of a copy of the actual bill. It's a resolution, is what it is. And I haven't been able to get a hold of much in the line of background information.
If the resolution's been filed, it should be on the City Council website under legislation.
I've looked in there. All I can find is a title.
And there, well, the
website is apparently undergoing some sort of reorganization.
The city website for legislation?
For legislation. And,
do you know the bill number?
I have a bill number. Let's see.
It's usually a good, all that stuff is like in the exhibits.
Well, I think it was 803.
Well, if one of us is
it,
not.
It's at
the very first, the list of, that we get of bills that are filed, the very first one.
Oh,
854.
Is that the Office of Economic Development?
Mm-hmm. The one for 450, the Rev grant for 450,000. Okay. Well, I know one of us is looking at it right now, so we may be able to help you out while we're here.
Well, the original bill is on the city website. There's an exhibit, LFS, whatever that is.
Legislative fact sheet.
Is that produced by your office?
No, that comes from the administration.
Okay.
I did get the something out of the
There's a number for the Office of Economic Development. The contact name is Ed Randolph, Director of Business Development. His phone number is 255-5450, edr@coj.net.
Oh, you can't even click on it.
You have to click on the bill number.
Oh.
To the left.
And that worked.
And frankly, I thought that maybe the FBI would be interested.
You refer this to Mr. Monroe of the Times Union?
Shall make for an interesting
read. But it looks like the... maybe Jeff can send it to you, but when you're in the actual bill, it has the agreement. Were there any other bills that got your attention?
No, that one took up a lot of my time.
The first one kind of took you to a rabbit hole.
It's like reading a novel.
It sounded that way, too. Does anyone have any questions for Mr. Roberts?
Thank you, Mr.
Roberts. Chair's comments. So a couple updates that you guys should probably know since the last time we've actually met, because... a lot has happened since the last time we've actually met. So the chair of the True Commission is an automatic member of the Inspector General Selection and Retention Committee. And we have met for, I think, in the last month, probably four times. Which, to put in perspective, we usually only meet twice a year. So... the four times was pretty abnormal. But you may or may not already seen it in the press. But the Inspector General, Lisa Green, was placed on administrative leave because of now four complaints that were filed internally within our office from city employees that reported directly to her within her office. To put that in perspective, her office has about 10 employees, including her, so that's a little under half. And because of the nature of the complaints, they're being investigated by the General Counsel's office. The complaints themselves are exempt from public record until the investigation is complete. But once the investigation is complete, then those findings will be reported to the Inspector General Selection and Retention Committee. We felt when we read the complaints during our meetings that they merited her being placed on leave. I can't speak to what was in everyone else's mind, but at least from my read of the complaints themselves, they definitely required some level of separation if they aren't authenticated by the General Counsel's office. They've completed the majority of all of their interviews. Most of them are internal. They're simply waiting on the last interview that they have to do with the Inspector General herself, Lisa Green. Part of her employment agreement with the city and all city employees are obligated to participate in any investigation on their employment if they're ordered to by their superior. In this situation, the Inspector General reports directly to the committee, so the committee voted to compel her to participate. So we're just waiting to hear back as to whether or not she will or she won't. But there are four factors in which a inspector general may be removed for cause: neglect of duty, abuse of office, harassment, and I always forget the fourth. But the goal is for us to be able to hear the findings, make a determination as to whether or not we want to pursue termination. If that were to be the route, then she's entitled to due process. So she would have notice. She would get the complaints themselves, the report that comes along with it. There would be a hearing in which she would be present in front of the committee, and then we would go over the report and provide an opportunity to explain any of the findings. And then if the committee were to take the step to terminate her at that point, then that would have to be affirmed by city council by a subsequent vote. So it's a long, drawn-out process that can, since it's something that would be filed with city council, would take the full council legislative period. And I imagine something like that would go before rules, but I'm not sure what committees of jurisdiction would touch that. Maybe Jeff could provide insight, but I imagine maybe rules and finance may be the two that may touch that particular issue. So I'm just giving you that heads up. if obviously the claims are substantiated, that's the path that it would take. In the interim, a interim inspector general was appointed at our meeting last week. Her name is Cheryl Goodman. She actually was one of the advisors that helped set up the office 10 years ago. She's very highly regarded. She's on one of the boards of the National Inspector Generals of the United States, and she's very well accredited. So she is going to be the interim inspector general until the end of January. And at that point, the committee will kind of reassess where we are. I will tell you the process of removing an inspector general and appointing an interim and appointing a permanent one is kind of drawn out. To appoint an interim, the committee can kind of do that on its own, but to appoint a full-time inspector general has to get both the committee's approval and council's approval. And I imagine that our hope is for us to find someone that is outside of the city. That was the general feeling from most of the committee members. We wanted someone that had the most level of separation from the city so that way there wouldn't be any potential conflicts. Some of the candidates outside of Ms. Goodman that submitted their applications did have some ties that gave people pause, even though they were very well qualified for the position. So that's one of the main reasons why they chose her as that's the synopsis of it, but I'm happy to answer any questions that anyone may have regarding that. Or anyone's feeling about it. It's okay. I will say, at least from my viewpoint, this one was definitely not something I expected. The last time we met outside of this whole issue was her evaluation. And at that point, the committee had graded her at a high level and given her a raise based on that performance. But it's a lesson, I think, for all of us that in the future we may need to provide more oversight into the office, not kind of just trust that everything's the mechanics of the office is working. So that's something that we're going to also need to address in the future. And then in addition to that, the committee may have to come up with processes that more clearly articulate what a line of succession is, and how you place an IG on administrative leave if they're the subject of investigation, because there wasn't really anything written down that kind of clearly delineated what happens when the IG is a subject of an investigation, mm-hmm. as opposed to the other way around. So OGC kind of had to use a lot of examples from other boards and commissions to kind of come up with the roadmap as to what we were supposed to do. There is a process itself as to what happens when an inspector general gets a complaint against them. The committee is the one that's supposed to review it. But in terms of a line of succession and administrative leave and how that all works, we kind of had to come up with that as we were going. So hence the reason why we've met so frequently. But I think the meeting that we had earlier this week on Tuesday should be the last one for a while. The next one most likely will be the one when we actually receive the report, and I'm sure that will be blasted around the press when that comes out. So heads up on that one. And like I said, if anything in that report is true, it's a cause for concern. So read it with care, and hopefully we can move out of this situation that office kind of finds himself in. But with that, happy to go to old business on the happier subject. So Commissioner Roberts, this is on the Sheriff's Office Comparable Cities Research, so that's Commissioner Day.
I have not looked at anything that was submitted by Mr. Merritt, so I was out for the last 10 days with COVID, but I have not done any work on that, so I apologize.
I know you kind of gave us a really detailed synopsis of what you were kind of working on. Is there any additional things that you would like to update on that?
I will bring that up under new business.
Okay. All right. Well, I know we do have the Peer City review from Commissioner Roberts, and I know that we asked him to kind of fine-tune it for us. So, Commissioner Roberts, would you like to present that?
Well, there's certainly a lot of stuff in it.
A lot of data, yes.
The main thing is that when you product is less. Hard things to overcome. I did find that as far as the money we spend, right up there, so we're taxing ourselves as much as anybody else. Well, I really wasn't prepared to really talk about it, so
give me questions next time.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
And then please make sure you come back with all the suggestions that you can, because I know Commissioner Roberts would love for us to be able to push this out, especially since it's so detail-oriented with a lot of that.
Thank you, Commissioner Roberts.
New business. Do we have any new business? Yes, sir.
I have a statement, and if you'll bear with me, this takes about 6 minutes. And Mr. Carter, did you get a copy of this?
I did.
Okay, great. The reason I'll bring that up when I finish. So this is a white paper I presented titled Staffing the Jacksonville Sheriff's Office, an Assessment of the Future. The Jacksonville Sheriff's Office consists of 6 operating departments. The Jacksonville Sheriff is accountable for corrections, Executive Office of the Sheriff, Investigations and Homeland Security, Patrol and Enforcement, Personnel and Professional Standards, and Police Services. The core law enforcement responsibility is the functional duty of two departments, investigations and homeland security, and patrol and enforcement. Some observations indicate that this core responsibility is under extreme pressure due to an insufficient level of staffing in these two departments. The calls for service duties are stretching the two units to their limits. This jeopardizes their ability to perform their primary functions, and it indicates that the Jacksonville Sheriff's Office is significantly understaffed. The Florida Department of Law Enforcement prepares an annual Criminal Justice Agency profile report. It breaks out the number of sworn officers for each police department and county sheriff's office in the state of Florida. The state average for police departments is 2.36, and 1.7 for sheriff's offices. According to the report, the Jacksonville Sheriff's Office has a population ratio of 1.96, which is above the state average. On the service, this suggests that the Jacksonville Sheriff's Office is adequately staffed. Jacksonville is unique among all Florida cities because of its consolidated nature. The Jacksonville Sheriff's Office performs all law enforcement in Duval County, excluding the three beaches area communities. From an operational perspective, the Jacksonville Sheriff's Office is analogous to a metropolitan police department, which happens to operate a jail and perform other constitutional duties required of a county sheriff. It is more appropriate to utilize the population ratio of a police department when analyzing the staffing of the Jacksonville Sheriff's Office. Based upon the state average of 2.36 officers per 1,000 residents for city police departments, the Jacksonville Sheriff's Office should have 2,223 officers when applying the ratio to the 2020 census number of 941,568. Jacksonville Sheriff Michael Williams spoke before the Jacksonville Taxation, Revenue, and Utilization of Expenditures Commission on Thursday, October 7, 2021. He stated that he currently has 1,827 officers in the two departments. For fiscal 2021-2022, the Jacksonville City budget provides for 1,854 officers in the two departments. Based on the 2020 census, the total population for Duval County is 995,568. Excluding the beaches area, it results in a population of 941,568. That produces a population number per 1,000 of 941.57, or 942 rounded. Using the state average of 2.36, Jacksonville should have the equivalent of 2,223 officers in the two core departments. The current staffing level for the two relevant departments should be 1,854 according to the city budget, and the JSO currently stands at 1,827. If the desired standard is 2,223 and the current approved staffing is 1,854, there is a deficiency in personnel of 369 positions. It is not possible to cure a deficiency of 369 positions in 1 year. Due to the limitations on the size of the training classes at the Jacksonville Police Academy, the addition of the staff must be phased in over a multi-year time frame. In an inquiry to Sheriff Mike Williams, he indicated that the academy can accommodate an annual addition of 150 positions. The identified staffing deficiency is for the fiscal year 2021-2022. As Jacksonville continues to grow, additional adjustments must be made in order to close the deficiency and maintain the staffing standard of 2.36 per 1,000 with the marginal growth of Jacksonville. The marginal growth is estimated at 2% per year with a 2% annual growth rate. The population of Jacksonville will grow by approximately 18,831 per year. The population per 1,000 is estimated at 18.83, or 19 rounded. With a desired standard of 2.36 per 1,000 of population and a population per 1,000 of 19, Jacksonville will need to add between 45 and 49 officers annually over the duration in order to accommodate the projected growth of Jacksonville. using a projected five-year period to close the deficiency gap. Jacksonville will need to add 45 officers the first year, 46 officers the second year, 47 officers the third year, 48 officers the fourth year, and 49 officers the fifth year. This is a total of 235 additional officers in addition to the current deficiency of 369. This is a total of 604 new positions over the five-year term. Jacksonville must add approximately 120 positions per year to be fully staffed at the desired standard of 2.36 by fiscal year 2026-2027. This increase in staffing will have a significant financial impact on the Jacksonville city budget. Sheriff Mike Williams has indicated that each new position will cost an average of $100,000 in the first year due to salary and benefits, along with the associated costs for a vehicle and related equipment. Based on the 120 additional positions in the first year, the total estimated cost is $12 million. Assuming the buildup in staffing occurs over a five-year period, there will be additional costs to allow for inflation. With a modest inflation rate of 3%, the incremental cost for the remediation of the staffing deficiency will be $12,360,000 in the second year, $12,730,800 in the third year, $13,112,724 in the fourth year, and $13,506,106 in the fifth year. Over the five-year buildup period, the aggregate cost is estimated at $63,709,630. The average annual cost for the public safety enhancement is estimated at $12,741,926. The looming question is, how do we pay for this investment in public safety? Over the four-year period ranging from fiscal year 2018-2019 to fiscal year 2021-2022, the ad valorem tax revenue has experienced an average increase of $53,445,500. The ad valorem tax revenue growth for the fiscal year 2021-2022 alone is shown at $57,481,000. Using the average growth of $53.445 million and the average annual cost of the public safety enhancement of $12.741 million, it reveals that this necessary public safety investment can be accomplished by utilizing only 23.84% of the marginal growth in ad valorem tax revenue. Using the marginal growth in ad valorem tax revenue of $57.481 million for fiscal year 2021-2022, the investment can be achieved for 22.17% of the marginal growth in ad valorem tax revenue. Based on the information submitted in this paper, it is evident that there is a significant deficiency in staffing in the office of the sheriff. This is the result of competing needs for public investment over the past several years. This is a deficiency that must be corrected very soon if the mission of the sheriff's office is to be executed successfully. I urge the Taxation, Revenue, and Utilization of Expenditures, TRUE Commission, to adopt a resolution supporting this approach to rectify the situation over the next 5 years, starting in fiscal 2022-2023, with completion in fiscal year 2026-2027. Respectfully submitted, Raymond L. Day, Member, Taxation, Revenue, and Utilization of Expenditures, TRUE Commission. Thank you.
Does anyone have any questions for Commissioner Day?
It potentially could, but this is a matter of the city council and the administration and the sheriff committing public safety as a priority, recognizing what I feel is an identified deficiency. And over a workable time frame, I think that we need to have the city of Jacksonville commit as a policy that we intend to correct the staffing deficiency. We also have to deal with about somewhere between 40 and 50 officers retiring every year. Now, those numbers already built into the sheriff's budget. We don't have to replace. In other words, that doesn't take any new allocation of the marginal growth in our tax revenue. And again, I focus strictly on ad valorem tax revenue. There are other funding sources that can be used for other departments in the city of Jacksonville. It is my opinion that we have a substantial deficiency in the primary function of city government, and that is public safety. And I believe I have identified a clear path for correcting the deficiency. I have identified, using my best estimates, which I think should be subject to confirmation from the council auditor, if that's an appropriate function of the council auditor, working in conjunction with Chief William Clement of the Jacksonville Sheriff's Office, Sheriff Mike Williams, and other interested stakeholders in developing a solution to what I believe is a significant issue facing this city. You can talk, if you go to the CPAC meetings and you hear what our officers are saying when they get up and talk about their respective zones, they're always talking about the intense burden of answering the calls for service that the officers in the zones, and that's primarily the patrol and enforcement area. I think some 1,300 positions in that department, another roughly 400 and something in the investigations and Homeland Security department. Those are your two core departments that really are on the front line of policing in this city. They are so stretched, they don't have the time to do the things that we would like our police officers to do, building community relationships, community-oriented policing, understanding the key players in each of the respective zones, understanding who are the repeat offenders, how do we address those issues. And I will submit additional supporting information. I just didn't have time due to my illness, but I felt it was important that I focus on presenting this paper today. For instance, an example of here's the term police violence. Oftentimes, police violence is because you have one officer who's responding to a very intense situation, who could respond in a different manner if there were backup, and if you had two to three, potentially four officers responding, depending upon the incident, you are then able to better engage the incident, de-escalate the situation, potentially preventing police violence. The police officers are so stressed, they will sometimes overreact. If we can provide this comfort level, to provide sufficient resources on the front lines, I think that we could see a dramatic improvement in how policing is done. We all know that we want our police to do the very best job we possibly can, but oftentimes that takes additional training. Certainly as we see this development of the co-responder program, Sheriff Williams has indicated, and I will get the backup support, the JSO has received federal and state grants that will enhance that co-responder program. But we have to recognize, if we commit to that type of a program, when those grants expire, it has to be a commitment from the mayor, the sheriff, the city council, and the citizens of the city that we want to commit the public resources to continue those co-responder programs that we know can provide direct benefit and help alleviate difficult situations in our community. So that's the nature of the paper. I would recommend as a way forward, when I presented my initial resolution last August saying that we should look at deficiency over the next six-month period, we're approaching at the end of that window, the February timeframe. What I would recommend is that allow me to pull together some additional supporting documentation that I have used in developing this analysis, both the Florida Department of Law Enforcement report, the relevant pages from the past city budgets that I used in developing the revenue projections, and additionally, some supporting information that the sheriff has committed to me they are willing to share about the co-responder program and other proposals that they would like to see incorporated. I have been in direct communication with the sheriff. I have been in direct communication with the leadership of the Fraternal Order of Police, and they are both, I don't want to use the term happy, but they are both, thankful that this commission is willing to entertain this issue, and I think they are waiting for a successful resolution of this issue. So I would propose that allow me to prepare some additional supporting information. Let's bring it back to the commission in January. If we could dedicate the timing at that commission meeting in January, January 6th, I think it is, for detailed discussion, and if we need to, take it over into February. But I would like to ask for this commission to vote on a resolution at the February meeting, certainly no later than the March meeting, that we can then take to the sheriff. The sheriff can then engage with the administration, because in that February-March timeframe, that's when the mayor begins to develop the preliminary work on the budget that will be presented next July, when the mayor and the sheriff will be presenting the next to last budget budget of their tenure. But in the fiscal 23-24, I'm told that it is the outgoing mayor and the outgoing sheriff who do the great bulk of the work in preparing that budget that will actually be presented by the new sheriff and the new mayor in July of 2023. So I think this we have time to develop a proposal and to assist the administration in terms of the mayor and the current sheriff that they can present to the city council for consideration, and that we can get the city council to commit that this is an important policy and we need to move in this direction. So thank you very much.
Had some questions, but I just want to wait to the end. Did anyone else have any other questions they want to direct?
How does our crime rate compare with our?
Well, I mean, that's something we need to develop.
Can we really work up a cost-benefit analysis? Because, you know, there's no end to the number of police you could put out there.
Well, that is a consideration. You have to realize this becomes a policy decision. This becomes a public question, a political issue for the public. Do we want to try and meet the state average and maintain that going forward? Do we want to hit a point and then we cut back on hiring? The city is going to grow. In the next 40 years, this city is going to add 1 million people.
Add, what's the effect?
Well, you have to have adequate staffing to respond to calls for service.
What's the effect? I mean, does it cost us more, or does it cost us less?
Well, it's going to cost more every year, yes. You don't reach a plateau.
I understand that. You've got inflation on top of it. And you've got productivity gains and losses and that sort of thing. Are the benefits greater than the cost?
Well, that certainly is the ultimate decision point. And you know, I'm of the opinion that doing nothing is not a direct cost benefit. I think it becomes a cost detriment.
We try or should be trying to run our government nationally and every other place by cost benefit analysis. We just can't go on feeling good.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Any other? I just had four questions that I think it would be great if we can come back and be able to answer, because I know this is probably this is the ones that I thought of immediately. The first question that I had written down, how would these new positions over the course of 4 years be absorbed into the department? Because you spoke about the seven main sub areas in which the workforce is in. So how would that new headcount be allocated?
My proposal is that the new headcount go directly into the two core departments, investigations and homeland security, and patrol and enforcement. And that through the ordinary course of growth in the sheriff's office, there are going to be additional staffing requirements in the other departments under the sheriff. But that's going to be a decision that the new sheriff will be having to make as they move forward. And there will definitely be, in my opinion, there will be a need to add overall to the sheriff's office, just as I think we're going to be seeing a need to add to staffing in city government in general as this city continues to grow.
I think we also need to be able to answer, when you talked about the state average of the 2.36, how many other sheriff's departments or police departments, for that matter, because I know you're using that as a model, fit that state average?
I can, that's all available in the FDLE report. Okay. It's a very extensive report.
Okay, and then the third and fourth question that I think we need to be prepared for is, are there other forms of revenue that you could use outside of the ad valorem increases that we were projected to have on a rosy scenario that everything's fine for the next 4 years, that you could use to absorb that cost? I thought immediately about the American Rescue Plan dollars, because that also can be used.
I didn't delve into that at all, because I really felt like this is a core function of city government, and that this should be funded out of the core source of revenue, which is ad valorem taxes. Okay. Again, that's my personal philosophy. That's how I approached it in doing the analysis. I know that historically the ad valorem taxes generated in Jacksonville have typically funded 80 to 90% of what we call first responders, meaning police, the sheriff's office, and fire and rescue.
I only mentioned the American Rescue dollars just because the city council and the mayor made the policy decision of using the first tranche for pay increases. That's not something that they used ad valorem dollars to kind of absorb. So if they've already made the policy decision that they're willing to use federal dollars for that type of purpose, it's not that far for them to do the same thing for the second.
I agree. And that's why I think once we present this concept to the administration, they may want to confer with the sheriff and they develop an alternate funding approach. The bottom line, my concern is we have to grow the staffing in the sheriff's office to correct the deficiency.
And then the fourth question is, I think the sheriff and many other groups have said that one of the reasons why the overtime cost that the sheriff's office currently has is because of the deficiency. So can there be a cost benefit as to
most how? Definitely. I think that's something that Chief Clement in the sheriff's office can assist in identifying, because as we staff up to adequate numbers of full-time equivalent positions, I think that relieves pressure of having to bring into play overtime compensation, which is at time and a half. And if we can, if we can build up the staffing of the frontline primary function, we actually end up saving substantial amount of money that's currently allocated to overtime.
Okay.
Yeah, go ahead.
Good job. When you talk about that, it could eliminate, hiring more police officers could eliminate some of the stressor, and maybe, you know, we won't have such violence won't go occur, which those are some factors. But my other factor would be training, better training. Yep. I know it's more factors, but you're
exactly right. And right now, because of staffing and the requirement for them to respond to calls for service, they have the equivalent, I think it's, and I'll have to confirm this, but I'm thinking from memory. I wasn't taking very good notes when I had lunch with the sheriff. They have the equivalent of 1 week a year for training. Not in my opinion. And he agrees, and the leadership at FOP, at the union, they agree. We need to come up, how much training do we need? Because you can't pull officers out of responding to calls for service if you don't have adequate reserves to replace that. And I think that it becomes a vicious cycle, and we just continue to you know, our quality of service devolves as opposed to improving. And that's what I'm trying to attack, is how do we really improve the overall quality of policing in Jacksonville?
Commissioner Tyson?
Possibly be a counter on, if you've got more officers so that you're reducing crime, then as far as the other part of the budget, the corrections may end up showing a decrease because you're not having crime being committed, which thereby goes into more people in the corrections.
Again, and those are elements I simply tried to abstract away and just deal with what I felt were the core functions in the two primary departments where that's our primary, you know, public safety delivery mechanism in those two departments. But you're right. There could
overall
be
budget-wise, if you have a decrease in that part of what we call administration or the corrections.
That's right. And again,
you're going to have your increases in your other, as your city grows, in your services part, but that might be a decrease in corrections could account for some of that other increase that you're normally going to have as your city grows and you have to have a larger department.
You're right. And you remember the sheriff did mention the report from the International Association of Chiefs of Police. He was in the process of sort of digesting that. And again, the incoming sheriff after the election in 2023, the new sheriff may have a different approach in how they want to manage the sheriff's office. And ultimately, we, the voters, have delegated that responsibility to an elected sheriff. And that elected sheriff is going to try and develop priorities and, I think, programming and financial strategy to fulfill the mission of that office. So I think this is an ongoing process. Like I say, this is a multi-year. I simply identified 5 years because that was the required time frame in order for the police academy to digest the numbers of new hires, in addition to the replacement of the retirees. There's a physical limit on how many people can go through the academy in the course of a year. We may discover this has to be done over a 6-year time frame.
I have another one.
Yes. Go ahead.
And I was thinking about, we discussed it when the sheriff was here about the having that, you know, when you have a cop, this, you know, bad cop. And at this moment, I think it's other peers, but it's, I don't believe there, if I want to be accurate, I believe there's not a citizen that can come in to, you know, partake in that. And I think that should change.
And
that's one of the, I'm just, as you wrote that report, I'm thinking about different factors, different things that we need to be doing, need
you're
to happen.
Exactly right. And
he told why he didn't want to do it, but I disagree. I think that we should. It need to be some kind of, sometimes you have to do some oversight. Just like when it comes to, we talk about different budgets and what have you. You know, they need oversight. We find a lot of them are not getting oversight in our hands. I might do a few things superficial, but not delving in there and getting deep in there. And I feel that we need to be deep, and we need to bring some other people, you know, some other perspectives to the table.
And also the Citizens Review Board, as it's called, it can exist, and it would simply take up issues after the confidential personnel process has been completed. And at that point, it may not be so much as addressing individual personnel as much as directing recommended policy changes that the sheriff can then implement. So I agree. I personally think there's some merit to some type of a review process. We know we're limited by state statute, by the fact that we have a constitutional officer leading our department, and the Florida Constitution has duties imposed on sheriffs that a traditional police chief doesn't have to deal with. So Jacksonville is a unique animal, and politically and in terms of our governance, and we as citizens need to craft, in my opinion, we need to craft a path forward that works for our city.
I think I appreciate that because it inspired something in my head. I think we also, since this is a policy recommendation, then I think we, policy-wise, we need to address the first question that always naturally comes with any city agency, indiscriminate of law enforcement, because I know that it serves a special purpose, but on par with everything else, kind of going with what Commissioner Roberts said, there are very few agencies that government is willing just to give a blank check to. Correct. Without any question. So I think if increased dollars is a direction which this current administration and future current administrations want to go in, I think that has to be tied to some level of accountability more so that exists right now.
I agree entirely, and I think that, you know, fundamentally, the city council controls the purse strings of this city. And I think that at some point, maybe a future city council will say, we would like to exercise a little more oversight over how our tax dollars are being spent by the sheriff. And to the degree that they are able to exercise that oversight, I think that's a legitimate policy question that should be undertaken.
Because there's something to be said about creating I think every agency always wants more people. I mean, that just goes
nature
without
of bureaucracy.
Saying. Nature of bureaucracy. I just think there needs to be some set of standard to justify the increase outside of there will be population growth, so you need more headcount. There has to be some kind of objective standard with objective metrics that city council can use and councils and administration can use to say X has occurred equals Y, X facto, we're going to do this.
And it may be that when we get in and we really dig into the FDLE report, it may come up with a metric that says the recommended number for Jacksonville is 2.5 officers per 1,000. Then it becomes a decision for the city council. Well, do we want to fund it at that level? Do we have to fund it at that level? Can we maybe drop back to the state average? Can we drop back to 2.3 or 2.25 and still fulfill the mission? And it might be that we start out at a 2.36 standard, and that as we add that personnel over time, we ratchet it back, maybe down to 2.3 or 2.25. But like you say, if we are approaching it from an objective set of data, then we can make those policy decisions.
Yes, sir.
Yes. 45 years, and I've never known one to say you've got too many people.
Yeah,
that you've got enough people.
Yeah, I know, it's almost six. I think the last thing I want to say, and then we'll close it out, because I think we've kind of done commissioner comments as well, is the fact that I think any increase over time, you have to also look at KHA and the funding that you do to prevent crime from happening in the first place, because it's not a one-sided solution to fix these type of issues. And you can't create a disproportionate situation where one side of the problem that's there to help prevent crime or stop crime gets increased funding, whereas the other side that's there to try to prevent the crime from happening in the first place gets the same kind of treatment that any other city agency receives, because you have to do both. But with that, the next meeting is January 6th. The Audit Committee and the Legislative Tracking Committee will be called at the call of the chair if there's a need to do so. Is there any other commissioner comments that you need to do before we adjourn?
No, thank you. Thank you for your forbearance in allowing me to deliberate on this topic as extensively as we did. So.
Of course. Entertain a motion to adjourn.
So moved.
All right. Move, seconded. Any objection? Seeing none, we're adjourned. Thank you, everyone.
Great meeting. Great meeting. I love the guests. I loved everything. I missed it last month. But that was keeping great. Then I'll bring it back next